This is a Niche Radio podcast. For more, visit www.nicheradio.co.za.
Good morning. Welcome to our Come Join Us podcast channel. We're this morning at the lovely Bomb Garage, and it's still wacky wine, and there's quite a few wackies outside, so we're enjoying all the fun. And while I'm in the Robertson Wine Valley, I thought I'd bring you to one of my favorite wine cellars in the States. It's Bomb Garage, and I've got the awesome Jean Perret with me here. Grew up together, live 5Ks or even 3Ks from here as well, my parents' farm as well. So my history with Bomb Garage, first wine cellar I worked at when I was younger. I used to play weekend sports and things like that, and then I had to at some point decide if I didn't want to pack fruit on our farm, I wanted to rather pull wine than pack fruit. So I started working in December with Jacques' sister, Maud. She had a lovely little coffee shop just around here, but she's changed now. It's also part of the whole building. And yeah, it was amazing. I think I learned a lot of wine, and I've always been a big foodie and winey. And yeah, it's very special to be with you here this morning, Jacques. Thank you for having me. I think number one, we should start with an oyster.
Yeah.
Because your oyster and your lovelies is what makes you.
Yeah.
So maybe I'll just pick it up there. So you want to show us what we are drinking?
Yeah, we're going to drink the Jacques Mabrut Reserve.
Okay.
2011 vintage.
Okay.
This wine actually is very special to me because it is a brainchild which was originated in 1990. My first release, the first bubble I did make. And this one was now also awarded with the National Wine Spirits Competition, the best in its class, the double gold, basically, the best sparkling wine. Unfortunately, we weren't allowed to compete with the champagnes because we're not
champagne.
We are not champagne. So we competed against the rest of the world, the sparklings of the world.
Okay.
And cheers to this. This is a blend of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, 60-40. Nice, rich, round creaminess. And then obviously we should have it with the oyster because the creaminess. And I would say always this is one of the exotic drinks that you have, or a style that you have in the wine industry. So why not have it with delicatessens from the sea? So we have some of these.
Divine. Ooh, one of my favorites.
Yeah, so you can grab one there.
Thank you very much. I'm going to put some lemon on it as well.
Yeah.
There you go, and I have our shot.
Yeah.
Shot from the sea. These are from West Coast oysters.
Yeah, West Coast oysters, because I believe that you need to have them. To me, I'm very fond of the West Coast oyster because it's from cold water. And I think that lends to give it more creaminess and richness. But not take anything away from the South Coast. Yeah, so thanks.
But you find them a bit more salty as well?
Yes, for sure.
And so that's what's nice about it.
I will rather prefer.
Things happen.
Yeah. So, as I said, to me it's just a favorite. To have an oyster from the West Coast, I think that is just how I...
And it's Saldana or whereabouts?
Yeah, Saldana. Yeah.
Saldana, okay.
Yep,
now, I also enjoy, I must say, if I like to eat oysters, I love eating West Coast oysters.
Mm.
It's always been a firm favorite.
Okay, can I just keep this a little bit?
Yeah, perfect. Fine. Okay. So, I know you matriculated also at Robertson High School, where I was. That's when I was born. So tell me, what made you become a winemaker? I know your father has done it. You've done it for years and years and years. How many generations already?
Well, yes, I'm third generation, so it's been in the family since the late 1920s. If I can maybe give you a little bit of history on the farm. My grandfather bought, he was actually originally from the Dewop area in Robertson. And they were two brothers, and the farm went too small for them to farm together. So he actually bought the farm in 1927 on a bankrupt auction.
Okay.
And it was, I believe, from the Dutch Reformed Church, which used this facility that we are where we are sitting now, was used as a training school for farm managers in those days. But yeah, they uprooted all the vineyards, so the cellar was here, because the previous guy made a little bit of wine prior to them. But they uprooted the vineyards, so the cellar became a stable for the horses and the sheep and everything. They farmed with ostriches and the peaches and apricots. So so yeah, it's maybe that's why the business didn't prosper, because they uprooted the vineyards. So yeah, my grandfather bought it, he replanted again. And then, yeah, set the ball rolling. So my father actually joined him in 1965, I think, on the farm. Yeah, and then in 83 we were registered as an estate. So I think that is really where we've bottled our first three wines. I know it was a Blanc de Noir, a Cabernet, and I think it was a Coron, a Chenin Blanc, was it?
Yeah.
And, yeah, so I joined in 1990. And, yeah, so how I became involved actually is that you grew up with it. You were in the vineyards all the time, riding with your dad on the motorbike, going to the cellar. I know my mother always brought me, while I was small, she brought me down to the cellar, and I worked with the grapes. I was very, because there wasn't any mechanical things. The wagons offloaded onto a platform, and then one guy had to work with a fork. He had to work the grapes into the machines or the crushers, and I helped him because I had a broom and I pushed the grapes forward. I think that's small things that actually was building like blocks. It just brought you more involved in the situation. And yeah, but really not, I wasn't aware that I wanted to become a winemaker, and it was really actually after matric, really, when I had to do my national defense, or we had to go to the National Service in the Defense Force. We had to do 3 years, and I was situated or stationed in the signals department in Heidelberg in Transvaal in those days, and I think it was there myself. I gave basic training there to the second year incoming. And I think that was where I decided to listen. Where I am now is not where I wanted to be. So, and I think that was the short and the sweet thing of it. Decide, making me decide, okay, listen, you must do something next year. So that is where I entered in for the agricultural college in Elsenburg.
Okay, great.
And yeah, and then actually it just fell into place. So I got selected. In those days, they only selected the top 10 students to become, if you wanted to do a winemaking course at this cellar. And yeah, so I was one of the 10. And I think I was also blessed with a block of Chardonnay then, and that is where the champagne actually also started to bite me. And they said to me, you're going to make up for sick. And yeah, and there was where I started it. And again, just when I got back to the farm, yeah, then it was the making of the cup to sick. And it was just actually also by mistake, because my father said to me, listen, you need to bring something different to the farm now, because I was doing managing the farm, I was managing the cellar, because it was a relatively small business. And so, yeah, he said to me, okay, what can you bring? I said, okay, well, I want to make the cup to seek. And actually, again, that is how the wheel turns. And we didn't have a basket press, because we had to press old grapes. And I said to him, well, listen, well, we need to have a press. And so I said to him, well, there under the oak tree is an old basket press. It's a 1952 model Baslin that was being taken out of the cellar. So now you can start it up again and then redo it. And actually, it was the same press that I was used to when my father, when I was like small in 1976, when he was pressing the grapes with that press. And now he just brought the press back and it was operating again.
That's
the soon and short of how I became involved. But yeah, it's, there's nothing else I want to do. It's making
that's wine. Incredible. Yeah. Well, that's what pure passion is.
Yeah, for sure.
I think, but passion is always a very loose word. I think people don't realize it's still you're really in it
and
you do what you really love till what ends meet.
Yeah, for sure. You will go at any length. To any length to just achieve your goal, and then you must be innovative, you must be inventive all the time. So but that's what's making it so nice, because I like to do different things. For me, I'm getting quickly bored of doing the same thing over and over again. So you want to have a challenge to do something new. And if you don't do it like that, then winemaking is not good, because you need to try to do new stuff.
How do you force yourself to innovate? What do you do?
You read a lot, obviously, and I taste a lot of wine, and you obviously must ask questions.
Yes.
You must be on top of your game all the time. Taste as many wines as you like.
Mm.
And just what did this guy do? How did they do it here? And then obviously you need to be friends with the whole industry. Just talk to them, and just by conversation, small things guys are saying, listen, this can work with me as well. So I haven't tried it before. And it's basically basic things.
Do you tweak your recipes with your wines every year, but keep it consistent?
We try to keep it consistent, obviously, because you want to have a certain style of wine.
Yes.
But nature is difficult, because you don't get each and every time the same
product.
Vendor or the same product. So you need to be on top of that. We try to keep the same standard. Obviously the standard must be high, but the same style, because you don't want to have different styles. Your brand mustn't go up and down.
Consistency
is the key. And then I think we can show that over our past record, that consistency is going on here, because of all the track record we have with all our wines, and not only with one style of wine, but like 8 different styles of wine and cultivars. So all of it making award-winning wine. Yeah.
And your whole family's involved still today.
The whole family. It's me. Peter is my younger brother. He joined us in 2006.
Yeah.
But he's not running the finances. My father is still in the farm, semi-retired, I would say, because he's still here every morning, and I speak to him every day. We do a lot of stuff. We ride together on the farm and just discuss all the stuff. I've got now Philip Fillion also, which is the new winemaker in the cellar.
And he's also from Robinson.
Robinson, actually. He's was one of our neighbors by farming about 2 kilometers from here. So it made me a little bit more versatile. So I'm not so hooked in the cellar now again. So I can leave a bit, and then I also can concentrate on in the vineyards as well.
No.
That's the thing that we try to achieve now, because I know that the cellar, all the stuff is running good with Philip taking care of there. So try to do it maybe better into the vineyards and. Because that is actually where the wine is made. Yeah, so
your father used to be mostly.
I'm sort of taking some over from him as well.
So
he can maybe go early in the weekend, maybe take a long weekend or something.
That always helps.
Yeah, for sure.
And you normally go to have holiday at Straceby.
Yeah, right. Straceby is, Cabergallus, not Straceby,
Cabergallus.
That's where I stay. I always say that is a bit further south than Straceby. But yeah, that is the place that I go to just relax, one arm. Whenever you need to clean your head, just go there.
You
just take it very quiet, evenings, obviously with a bride, but then maybe read or watch a little bit of television.
You catch fish?
And obviously that is one of my hobbies, to catch fish. Straceby is one of the hubs in South Africa these days. A lot of marlin actually is coming out there, also tuna. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we are. But basically, Straceby is famous for the yellowtail and the cob, and that is the thing. But yeah, we do that.
Awesome. So before, you've obviously worked here a lot, and did you travel maybe a little bit overseas, going to see how different it is overseas and what they do?
Yeah, for sure. When I joined my father in 1990, I had the opportunity. I know still Lonnie Lawrence. He was then. Actually working with Nittelshof.
Okay.
He had a contact for me in Germany, actually. So, again, it just goes to show how things work. Because he couldn't go, so he phoned me up and said, listen, I've got this job. Would you like to go there? And I said, well, yeah, by all means, I'd like to see how the German guys do. Because we were new world, but they were the first world. So the old world style, you need to see what those guys are also doing. But yeah, there I worked in a big cellar, so not really actually... seeing how the practices is, but just to see how a German cellar operates, because everything is clinic. I can say it's just like
clinical.
By doing only 3 or 4 guys, do 10 guys work in that cellar, so they are. We were actually, I was in the preparing of the wine for filtration and stabilization just prior to bottling. And so that was also a nice excursion for me. And then the year afterwards, we went actually a bit of backpacking. I actually went with two friends. And we were short of money. So we signed up there at in the Bougelay, I think it was. We signed up there for a harvest. And we lucky got it. And we first were working in the vineyards by picking grapes, and then they took me to the summer because I told them, with my broken French, which I said, basically non-existing French, then they took me to the summer and said, okay, you can run the presses for us. And so that's when you learn to do stuff their way and stuff. So yeah, that was nice, yeah.
Did you work mostly with Champagne more?
Well, what type of stuff? No. That was, the Beaujolais was basically Pinot Noir, but yeah. It was fresh young wines to be drunk.
Okay.
So basically no experience in France or in Champagne area, but that experience I learned myself and
yeah.
Taught myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, and also learning what other guys are doing. And
yeah.
There's a lot of guys that you can just go and talk to.
So some of my favorite wines is Jacques and God is the Ancora range. And
yeah.
Tell us about your Ancora wine. That's his prime red wines.
Yeah, that was also the second wine I introduced, the range I introduced to the farm. It was done, the first vintage was done in 2001. Actually, when I was now settling more into the wine king here on Bankaraja after the MCC was now running good, my father said to me, well, listen, now we must do something else because we need to build the brand, and but we must do something different. And we were, all those things of terroir and site-specific vineyards were coming into play. And so, yeah, so we decided, we've got a vineyard which I think is very site-specific. There's a block of Shiraz, so it's the first wine that we actually did as a single vineyard.
Yes.
And then we had to, obviously I had to call it a name. And then I know Farnes, my cousin, Farnes Brevet from Quantum Wines, actually he helped me with the wines, or the name, because it was actually a guy.
Tell us about the name. I didn't know
that
at all.
We thought of bringing the fourth generation into it. And he said, well, listen, you've got three children. Just take abbreviations from their names. And that was Inga, I-N, and then K-A-R was Carlin, and then A for Andre, which is my younger son. So Inkara. It's a lot of people say Inkara, but basically I would say more Inkara.
That is our
flagship Ritz. We're doing a Cab, we're doing a Shiraz, and then a Merlot as well.
Okay. But your flagship Shiraz?
The Shiraz, I think, the Shiraz is the most consistent, and I think it's the one that's actually doing the best for doing a red wine in that style.
Okay.
I think Cabernet is also doing good sometimes, but Cabernet is difficult in Robinson, so you need to have the right climatical conditions.
Mm.
Otherwise, it's good, but it's not the best.
Yeah, it's so lovely to talk about doing reds also in Robertson, because we mostly know you for Chardonnay.
Yeah.
And I mean, and how the styles you adapt with it as well. And do you also find you also on a lot of limestone as well, all the other parts?
Yeah, no, for sure. I think all our Chardonnay grapes, especially the ones that we produce for the Cuvée Rosé, also the Pinot Noirs, actually also it stands on that. How can I say now? This Chardonnay basically is all gravelly soils, gravelly soils, chalk, and then the red grapes basically is in the middle of the farm, more alluvial soils, which is more because we on the farm we had basically three different styles of soil, because there's two side branches from the river, actually the Brenner River that runs through the common. Over these years they brought a lot of different soil types for us from the Langeberg.
Yeah.
By the Karoo soils, I think the lime actually came from the Karoo.
Yeah.
Which was because we are on the plateau of the Brenner River. So when the river starts to flow when it enters the river, the side branches it leaves the soil here, and that's actually what happened.
That is quite interesting. Yeah, yeah, especially with all the soil type.
Yeah.
So Jacques is going to show us exactly how to pop a proper bottle of MCC.
It mustn't pop, actually. It must just sigh.
That's exactly right.
Let's go and see how it goes.
What have you poured in our fire?
This is the Cuvée Rosé Brut. It is our 100% Pinot Noir, also from the 2011 vintage.
Don't you find a Pinot Noir is quite a very difficult type of grape?
It is a difficult type of grape, but not as difficult to make while you do it as a base one. It's really a challenge to make as a red wine. I must say, it's a challenge for us in Robertson. Because
there's not a lot here.
Yeah, there's not a lot of people. No. We try to make ones. It actually happens every 5 years with some of them. I'm actually sort of, this is not, there's not continuous vintages. Okay, sometimes we will use more for the whoever is able, but we do sometimes make, but just a little bit, say for 3,000 bottles, so it's very little. But we struggle, what I struggle with here is that the wines are fermenting very nicely, and then just after your malolactic fermentation, then you use it with volatile acid. And that is, I think a lot of these guys, we all got the same problem, so that is a challenge for us to overcome. But yeah, as I said, it just shows how different it is in the styles, because when we press the whole bunches now for the base ones, there's lesser phenols in it because we only use like 600 liters per ton. Mm-hmm. And that wine, when they ferment, they're so beautiful, and you can leave the wine on the lees without any sulfur, and it doesn't pick up so much volatile acid. It just comes to show it. I think it all depends on how you work with the grapes. And so what we're going to do next year is probably that we will make our red wine with whole bunches, but now in the end you will press now. You can't actually do it like that because you need to ferment on the skins to get the color.
Yes.
So by pressing it gentle, it's not going to work with red wine, but you can do it with the base wine.
Why don't you normally keep it on the skins for your base wine?
Basically, we don't keep it on the skins. We just press, and we press a little bit harder. Normally, we will press the white caps, we will press 500 liters per ton, we will press 600 liters. So just to give you, will see, this is a very light
product. Very light, yeah.
And to me, I don't really mind too much about the color. I just need a little bit of pinkiness or a coppery color to it. So that is, to me, is adequate for rosé. So I don't want to make it too pink to say, yeah, this is a pink wine. Mm. Because that is not where it goes. It's darker in color maybe, but coppery. That is what I would like. For me, that is adequate for it.
Why are you bubbles normally on the lees?
On the lees, not shorter than 5 years or 60 months. The 2011 now spent 70 months on the lees. So that is why we try to find it. And basically that is because we are an estate. We are declaring vintages every year. So to me that's a single vineyard. So it's a single vintage that we enjoy, and that's something special. So that rather keep it long on the lees and make a...
It's expensive,
though. It's not expensive. It's not expensive. I think you have to do it the right way. There's only one way, that's the right way.
And production-wise, how big is your production? So about
Our production is about 50 to 70,000 bottles per year. I think we're not going to grow it bigger than that because I would need to invest in hand brewing. I'm hand brewing. I will have to.
Really?
Not me.
What hand wriggling means is that you need to turn how often?
We do it in the morning and then also in the afternoon. So it's twice a day, eighth of a turn. So
60,000 bottles.
Yeah. You can see, you will see.
Turn in Sunday. There you go.
Can I lift it?
Yeah.
Okay, you see, there's a mark there. Can you see that mark?
Yes, there I can see it.
Okay, now that mark actually shows that the bottle was marked. That is for the riddler to see how far he must turn the bottle each and every time.
And they are precision?
Yeah, they are precision. We start, say, at 12 o'clock or 6 o'clock, and then it starts to turn. And in the end, you make a full rotation, and then all the leaves go down into the jewel. And So we will have to invest in jar pans, which is mechanical things, which is
good. That's what they use in champagne.
Yeah.
But that's like the big houses, like Moët.
They don't show that to you, because obviously they need to have those machines to do it, but they will show you that the people are still riddling. So there is professional riddlers in champagne, for sure.
Yes, it is. That's perfection. And your guys at Hughes, they've been doing it for years.
Yeah, for sure, for 20 odd years. How long have they been producing that? 25 years, we've been.
You only have two or three that does it?
I've got two guys who are doing it. It takes them, I turn 10,000 bottles at a time, so that takes them about 20 minutes to off the bottle.
to 10,000 bottles.
Yeah,
that's
insane. That's quickly.
Yeah.
You use two hands, not one hand.
Yeah, the whole time. Awesome. So, and other white wines, or other wines, I know that you've got Blash, that most people know as well.
Blash is
a very, a little bit more sweeter. It is a bubble. I think you can sort of explain to us what is the difference between your Blash and an MCC.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. Well, MCC obviously is the classic method of champenoise. The Blush is a carbonated wine, actually. We impregnate it with carbon dioxide so you get bubbles, so it's not natural. But it's made from a grape Muscadel, which is very similar or synonym to Robertson. Now, Muscadel, obviously, as you know, all is this is normally fortified wine with higher alcohol. So we decided to give it a bit of a treat, and we fermented the Muscadel dry, and then we sweetened it again. And then we put some bubbles in it, so it's like a cider. And then I know that the young people, I would say tomorrow's wine drinkers, we introduced them, they got introduced to Blush, sparkling wine, because sparkling wine is obviously the higher end of the market. Sparkling is a hype at the moment, the bubbles is uplifting. So but I think those drinkers will eventually go over to proper MCC.
Yeah, no, totally. I agree with you because I had, when I was at school and then obviously trained in a chef in Stellenbosch and then I met friends there. And most of my friends also that doesn't come from the Western Cape and so forth as well. And they start all with sweeter wines. And eventually today they all drink white wine and bubbly, dry bubbly.
And then, the white wines we produce, we also do the Gooseberry Bush Sauvignon Blanc, which is a very tropical style. Sauvignon Blanc to me is also one of the favorites to drink, because normally when you don't know what to drink, you drink Sauvignon Blanc. Because it's just so versatile, because there's so many flavors coming through. I'm not such a particular fan of the greenness. It's nice to have it in there, but you want to have more flavors. For me, that's maybe sometimes quite one-dimensional. So I want something which is tropical, which is nice and easy to consume.
Yes.
And every time you sip it or taste it, you get something different.
Yes.
So that is what making for me that a challenge as well. And if you make a good Sauvignon Blanc, then the whole vintage is just even better, because Sauvignon Blanc is some of the grapes that comes in first, and everybody wants to know how's the Sauvignon Blanc this year. And I say, if that is good, then everything is good, so then we can go with ours.
So I'm going to ask you a personal question.
Yeah.
If you don't drink your own wine, whose wine do you drink? What wine do you drink?
There's quite a lot of wines that I would like to drink. Chardonnay if it's Chardonnay, obviously I would drink the site of the Wetzel.
Yes.
Sauvignon Blanc, I like the New Zealand styles, the Cloudy Bays, I like the Marlboros, I like it. There's wines that I also. We were introduced into the wines when I was just started making wines. They actually gave us they brought all the winemakers those days together and showed us the New Zealand styles of wine, the New World styles, because everybody was running or were trying to make this the same thing as the French or the Germans and stuff like that. So we got a few guys, I can't remember, I know Aubrey was involved there, and Eugene Van Sale was involved, and a lot of David Bailey, all those guys, and they brought in a few New Zealand styles, and then they let us taste that, our industry taste that there was, and said, well, listen, this is what we actually should do, because this is their world, and this is the world, and that was, I was always hooked to that new world styles of wine. That is basically with red wines. Yeah, the Grevel red wines is good. The Shiraz is nice. I like them. And then obviously also Land's End wines.
Yes.
The Overbergs area is also making amazing stuff.
Yes.
When they get the yields right, because I know that they always struggle with the Southeaster that actually do their summer pruning for them. But that's a nice story.
Well, Jacques, it's been fun. I want to say personally thank you so much for inspiring me. Because I had such a great time working with you guys when I was
in school. Thanks again, and thanks for all your insights. I think in the beginning it was really hard, but I think Yeah, you had something to do with the making of it, so
that is... No, I absolutely love what I do, and I really get inspiration from people such as yourselves. So, cheers, and cheers to Bongarol. Cheers to you all. Yeah, likewise.
Cheers.
Subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or log in to www.nicheradio.co.za.